You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Wednesday morning, so we are officially one week of President Biden. The last three Wednesdays have been, you know, eventful.
So we're taping this on a Wednesday. I hope that this is that we break the streak.
though we had an insurrection, impeachment, inauguration. We at least have trial. We have the trial is. I know that the swearing in was yesterday, but they are working on a bit of a double track, getting some people confirmed. But we are still in a period of eventful Wednesdays. Were you at all rattled that so many Republicans in the Senate voted to dismiss the charges, or were you expecting that?
I wasn't terribly surprised, only because I've come to learn that really, what was the P.T. Barnum line? Nobody ever lost a dime underestimating the intelligence of the American public, something like that. You could never lose by, underestimating the courage of the Republicans. So I wasn't surprised. And it's honestly merely the latest data point in a long litany that I'm happy to regale you with of all the things, just the continuing decline of the Republican Party just since the storming of the Capitol.
Is it possible that some Republicans who voted to dismiss could still vote to convict?
Sure. I mean, we don't know what evidence is going to be presented. It is possible that there would be evidence that would compel people to change their minds, but it's certainly not a good sign.
I mean, I would think, I should say, I think it would seem possible to me that there'd be some, not that I think we would get to 17 and Trump would actually be convicted. That strikes me as very difficult unless McConnell really, really leaned in at some point. But you could say, hey, I voted to dismiss because I'm not sure about the constitutionality of having this trial after Trump is out of office. But I lost that argument. We had the trial. I saw the evidence, and I thought there was enough to convict.
But that's under the assumption that the concerns about the constitutionality are made in good faith. And I believe that is sophistry. They're invoking a bogus argument that has the benefit of sounding thoughtful and serious and nuanced, and because they simply have decided that they're not going to impeach or remove Trump. So I think that the odds of someone doing that in good faith are unlikely. However, I think it is possible, not likely, but possible, that there could be some evidence that comes forward that would change public opinion and everything. And so, I wouldn't say it's impossible, but highly unlikely that, what would I say? Right now, seven to 10 votes in the Senate, maybe?
To convict?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of
from Republicans. I would say seven. Seven's probably my, if you put a gun to my head today.
If McConnell wasn't a quit, I might think 7 to 10. If McConnell was to convict, maybe that changes.
I think you might be too optimistic, but then again, maybe I'm too pessimistic based on experience of the last year. And remember, Bill, I made a little news by saying the last impeachment that I thought it was possible. I didn't predict that it would happen, but I was saying, look, it's possible that the Senate, could rise to the occasion and convict. And of course they did not. And their track record of doing the right thing is not great.
Well, I don't necessarily think if they did convict, it would be out of honor and decency. I think it would be Mitch McConnell saying, look, we can't survive as a party with the poison of Trump still coursing through our veins. He's not going away. We're not going to get rid of him without a fight. And yeah, it's gonna suck in the short term, but we need to take the first step and ban him from running for office and suffer the short term consequences. I'm willing to lean in and do that. Are you with me? I mean,
Yeah,
yeah.
but that's because Mitch McConnell plays the long game.
Well, right. I mean,
And everyone else, these are all a bunch of day traders. They're just trying to survive the day, and they can read the room, and the room says, I'm with Trump. Everything they're hearing from their voters, from their supporters, says, do not go against Trump. And so they're a bunch of
that's
cowards.
why I think you would need a McConnell to say, I need you to play the long game with me and, find those folks who are probably older, who are not as concerned about the next election, who are not up in 2022, and try to corral those 17.
But I've been surprised that, and I think the argument you just made was pretty compelling, and it sort of a year ago or a year and a half ago, and when they tried to impeach Trump, I thought that might carry the day. But I've been surprised that people who are retiring don't seem to have any more courage or flexibility or freedom than people who are not. I've been surprised that people who are older and should know better have not tended to. Now, they might have better excuses or more nuanced arguments for why they're coming down. But by and large, it has not been the case that people who are not up for re-election, that people who are retiring, or that people who have some age and presumably wisdom, it has actually not been the case that they have behaved any differently or any more courageously than the rest of
That's generally true, and I think
them.
Tim Alberta at Politico and others have made the case that they don't get liberated when they decide to retire. They still want to be in the party's good graces, whether it is for business reasons, they want to get a lobbyist job or get hired by a Republican-friendly corporate board or whatever, or they want to run for some future office. Well, they just don't want to get harangued on the street, in their neighborhoods and communities. There are other pressures that compel them to still salute. I think there's a little bit of evidence that that might be different this time around. If to shift a little bit away from, impeachment, Pat Toomey. And look, and Pat Toomey is not a guy I was expecting to be wonderfully liberated. This is a pretty doctrinaire conservative. He's never been a secret moderate, but he's been pretty vocal against Trump, and he was one of the five that did not vote to dismiss. So I do wonder if maybe he's a little bit in play for other things in the next 2 years, because this is someone who would be up in 2022 and said he wasn't going to run again.
Yeah, no, I agree with that because I think Toomey, well, just to, I think Toomey would have, in his heart of hearts, Toomey would want to impeach or convict, and he's also liberated to do so. So I think you may be right in that case, but I
And I
think he's
wonder
the
about Rob Portman.
exception that proves the rule, I think.
Everyone's looking at Rob Portman's decision not to run in 22. The general analysis that I see is this is more evidence of the rot inside the Republican Party that a guy like Rob Portman doesn't want to stick around, doesn't want to deal with the Trumpers. Not that that's wrong, but it seems incomplete to me. Why would he announce today that he's not running again, but is not quitting? Said he's going to keep his seat till 2022. The only reason I would think is he actually wants to do some bipartisan things, and wants to hold on to the seat so he can do that without fear of electoral repercussions. This is a guy who, there's a thing called the Lugar Index. There's a Lugar Center. Richard Lugar was a moderate Republican senator.
From Indiana, Bill. I know I wrote my thesis on him, but for those who don't know.
And he's one of the few senators in history to lose a primary on ideological grounds. And they have a bipartisan index where they don't track what you got in pass, but what you sponsor, which is a lower bar. But nevertheless, it does show you some indication of how often people make some attempt to be bipartisan. And Portman has the fourth highest rating. It's a lot of small bills. He's never done the big break, but he has relationships with the other side. He was involved in the bipartisan COVID relief talks last month. And so I don't think it's out of the question that he becomes a more likely candidate to be part of a group of 10 that joins Democrats on, I mean, not everything. He's not going to pass the entirety of the Biden agenda, but on something. So it's not the silver bullet, but it's a piece of the puzzle if you're thinking that 60 is still a possibility for certain issues.
But the larger point that you made and then sort of hand-waved it away is that he's going to be gone in 2 years. And so we're losing a guy who scores high on the Lugar index. And, you know, if you look at the news right now, the people who are running are like, maybe Jim Jordan will be the next senator from Ohio. And maybe Laura Trump will be the next senator from North Carolina. And basically, it feels like the QAnon wing, for lack of a better term, of the Republican Party is ascendant, and the decent. I don't even, you know. And by the way, I think the establishment part of the problem with the Republican Party is that Trump was right that the establishment actually is impotent, actually is weak, and part of that is by virtue of them fleeing. They just leave instead of sticking around and fighting, but they're leaving. And so it does seem to me that this bigger trend is that we're losing the people who might be willing to do the right thing. And we're getting a lot of bad people.
I think it's a little premature to assume that the Ohio Republican Party is one going to nominate a hardcore Trumper / cure to be the nominee.
Well, and by the way, I don't know if Jim Jordan, I don't want to, you know, I don't think he's a Q guy per se, but right.
He's a Trump.
What's a good way, a good derisive term for him that would be appropriate or accurate?
Accomplice to pedophilia?
What?
Accomplice to pedophilia?
I will say the insurrection caucus just for, because I don't want, you know, I know Blogging Heads has a team of lawyers on call, but I feel safer saying the insurrection, which in and of itself is a big thing to say.
Right. So I mean, look, I can't tell you today that Jordan will not be the nominee. Maybe he will, but I wouldn't assume he's the nominee or someone like him is the nominee. And if one is, I wouldn't assume that person wins the general election. You know, I mean, we have conflicting Ohio data points. On one hand, it voted for Trump twice and not by altogether close margins. On the other hand, its current governor is Mike DeWine, you know, a pretty establishment moderate Republican, certainly on the current spectrum of Republicans. His predecessor was John Kasich, who endorsed Joe Biden. And, you know, Sherrod Brown's still hanging around as an Ohio senator, although maybe, you know, his days are numbered there.
You don't need to be a weatherman to know which way the wind is blowing, though.
Well, I think the argument that you get a Trumper is that the party in Ohio is changing and Kasich and DeWine are lagging indicators or laggards, I should say. So this is when, you know, the key is going to turn. But DeWine is still someone I think who has a pretty decent approval rating in Ohio. I haven't checked the numbers lately, so correct me if I'm wrong there. He still has got cards to play. If DeWine wants to get involved in the Senate primary, I'm sure he could. You know, again, I don't know if he can snap his fingers and make things happen, but he can. He has some weight to throw around. So I would just say,
if you'll indulge me, Bill, I've been collecting. Sadly, I've not organized this, but I've been collecting things just since the last week or two of the Republican Party.
Okay.
So you've got Portman out, Toomey out, Texas GOP doing some crazy QAnon thing I need to look into. They're censuring The Arizona Republican Party has censured Cindy McCain, Jeff Flake, and the governor, Ducey, of their state. Liz Cheney was censured by maybe the Wyoming GOP, definitely one of the counties, and may lose. They're going after her leadership position. You've got Marjorie Taylor Greene. She is definitely Q adjacent. Mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say mm-hmm. that, Bill. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's some new comments emerging, or Facebook comments or likes about wanting to kill Pelosi or things that she's associated with. You've got Nikki Haley and Marco Rubio, the two people who in 2016 I thought were the future of the party, basically saying, like, let's move on. Let's not be vindictive. Let's just Trump be in Trump, right? Is that the end of my list? Oh, you've got Huckabee Sanders running. I forgot her on my list. I assume she's going to be the next governor of Arkansas, but you never know. Michigan, I think the state of Michigan is trying to fire the canvassers who correctly certified the election there. Is that it? Did I miss anything?
I mean, I'm not sure if it's fully exhaustive, but I mean your point. I mean, I don't disagree with the underlying point that the Republican Party has a Trump problem, has a Q problem, is in the middle of a low-grade civil war that the Trumpers are trying to purge and exert dominance in the party. I don't dispute any of that. I think it is still an unknown, to what extent the establishment wing is going to engage in abject surrender, and how many of them are going to fight. And to that end, so to get beyond just what the Republican Party, the Republican Party's future, how many people are willing to break ranks and work with Democrats in the Senate and actually pass things? I mean, so all that you say can be true while a smaller faction still is cooperative. There was a bipartisan group of 16, I think mostly senators, evenly divided, who met with Biden's economic advisor on Sunday and talked about COVID relief. And when they said, I think your price tag is too high, the Biden people said, okay, we'll check our numbers and get back to you. I mean, there is some bona fide dialogue going on. So I just don't think you can take all the bad data points that you have. I mean, you shouldn't ignore them, of course. But I still think we should be careful about how far we extrapolate that to assume, well, this must mean that we're in a total state of political paralysis and nothing's ever going to get done.
No, I think that's true. I think that the Republican Party is going through major problems, and but that'll play out over the course of months and years. And you're right. I mean, that doesn't necessarily impact the short term of this administration. Now, Bill, you may know.
Well, it could help it. I mean, I think a more divided Republican Party potentially makes it easier for Biden to find Republicans to work with, because there are people who are going to say, I don't want to be part of this nonsense.
Right. I think it also overshadows the problems of the left. And I mean, I have a column in the Daily Beast pointing out all the bad progressive things Biden has done in the first week that have pissed me off. But, compared to trying to overthrow the government, it doesn't seem that bad. I mean,
what are you so mad about? What is Biden that is so horrible to get your dander up?
Well, look, I mean, does my dander seem, you could probably tell that I'm not as passionately upset yet, but I just think Joe Biden ran for office and he talked about a lot of stuff. Don't get me wrong. He talked about climate. He talked about, racial reconciliation or whatever, but mostly he talked about healing and unity and not being Trump. And so I think there were a lot of people like me, not me, but people like me, who are sort of center-right suburbanites who voted for Biden because...
I mean, you voted for Biden in the primary, not the general.
Right, right. But there were a lot of people like me, center-right suburbanites, who did vote for Biden based on the premise that Donald Trump was horrible, and that Biden was going to be the opposite. He was going to be a healer, a uniter. But Biden, just in the first week, has done several things that are, you know, sort of sops to the progressive left. And so I feel like that, you know, so like the Keystone XL pipeline is one example that I wrote about. The Paris Climate Accord is another. The notion that there should be a $15 minimum wage somehow attached to COVID relief is another. The Mexico City policy, which is not surprising, but it's another. I mean, if you're a conservative, you don't have to be I'm not talking about a right-wing MAGA Q. I'm saying, like, if you're a mainstream Reagan conservative, Biden has done a whole bunch of stuff this week that should upset you, that goes against what you believe to be good public policy. And I feel like, well, on one hand, I get it, but shouldn't he be wanting to bring us into the fold? And, you know, if he was, I think it's almost like a bait and switch. Like, he ran on don't be Donald Trump. And now there's the talk, Bill, about getting rid of the filibuster, which I don't think is going to happen anytime soon. Well, but
that's not Biden talk.
It's not Biden's talk, but it's, you know, I think it just part of the argument to vote for Trump if you're a Republican was, you know, Biden's going to come in and the left is going to take over and they're going to do all these things, all this left wing stuff. And some of it's going to be done via like executive order, you know, or it's going to be pushed through with reconciliation, or they're going to get rid of the filibuster and then they're going to do DC statehood and Puerto Rico statehood. And like, I guess my point is, I felt like Biden was running arguing this is going to be a return to normalcy. We're going to get, you know, we're going to care about institutions again. We're going to care about the rule of law. We're going to, you know, and it's kind of being chipped away right now.
Well, I think you're conflating some things there. And so there's executive orders. There's Biden's big legislative asks. And there's the reconciliation possibility. And there's the filibuster controversy. So on the executive orders, you know, those are the things that are, you know, more, acutely progressive. This is pretty standard practice. The new president comes in. What can they do unilaterally? What can they do to make the base happy? You know, every president does set a bunch of executive orders off the top, say, look, you know, we're hitting the ground running here.
I would say it's a bad trend, but you're right. It's a trend, but this makes part of my argument is that Biden this first week is not presiding as a new politician who's going to, he's doing what they all do.
I don't think that's correct because I think you have to look at it in the context of what's happening with these bipartisan talks. And Biden is someone who has repeatedly said he wants to be bipartisan. Had a meeting with a bipartisan group within his first week. Not only had the meeting, but then came out of it and said publicly, you know, we're going to respond to their concerns and talk about where we can find common ground. He didn't have the meeting and say, screw off, guys. He clearly indicated he was going to have, you know, the give and take with them. So, you know, Biden has to engage in a degree of base management if he's going to maintain a coalition that can get the progressives and the moderates and a few Republicans to come together on something. So he's got to give the base something. And certain things like, you know, Keystone Pipeline, Paris. I mean, Paris is pretty central to the Democratic Party to do something on climate change. I mean, that's not exactly bending over backwards to appease the left. I think the Mexico City, you know, abortion-related stuff is also pretty down the middle Democratic things.
It is, which is why I could never vote for a Democrat.
Well,
for
like, what's why? I'm not saying you like that,
but I think it's worth just revisiting because this was a big argument that I've had mainly on Twitter, mainly not here, but like, how could you not, it wasn't enough that I didn't vote for Trump. It was like, how could you not also vote for Biden? And this is why.
I get why you wouldn't vote for him in the general for those reasons, but I don't think this is evidence that Biden has become a wild left winger who's not going to try to find the middle ground. But my
point always was, he doesn't have to. This is what the Democratic Party stands for. This is what being a normal centrist Democrat gets you.
A normal centrist Democrat is going to be pro-choice and do things on climate change. That is true.
Not just do things, but do the Keystone XL pipeline. So much of the Democratic climate agenda, especially things that have been pushed through this week, in my opinion, don't actually solve the climate. They don't even move us in the right direction.
Well, think mind you, Keystone, Biden is somebody Keystone who has said
it's symbolism over substance.
I think Keystone is a little more of a symbolic move because, remember, Biden is someone who is not someone who believes you should keep it all in the ground. Biden is not for a flat ban on fracking. Biden is not for ignoring natural gas as part of the energy mix. So this is something that kind of keeps that wing of the Democratic Party happy, while he's also probably preparing to do things on climate that are not Green New Deal-esque. You know, Joe Manchin is the chair of the Energy Committee now. And Joe Manchin said that he's not doing anything on climate that does not include carbon capture technology that keeps coal in business. This is something that the hardcore enviros despise. But I don't think Biden's going to get crosswise with Manchin on that. I just think you got to look at these things in a broader context and not assume that the one decision portends everything else is going to follow in the same line.
Well, that may be. I'm just saying he's been in office for a week and I was able to put together, let's just say I couldn't keep it to 750 words as I like to do. This was more, a little bit more substantial. And there were things I didn't even talk about in that column, and people should read it at the Beast. But look, I hear from other people like, and you, basically what you've just said is like, don't, you know, like this is not indicative of what is to come. And I'm just, maybe you're right, but I'm always nervous when I hear, when someone tells me like, you know, it'll get better. He'll calm down. I'm always nervous when I hear that, but sometimes it's true.
Well, I want to talk about reconciliation filibuster. I actually have a piece that I wrote for The Washington Monthly. It's not published yet. It's still in the editing process.
And I just interviewed Michael Tomasky.
Oh, great.
Yesterday about the filibuster as well. So
is he for eliminating the filibuster?
Hard. Yeah, he is. He is hardcore.
So as folks here know, and I've written about this before, I'm not for eliminating it. I mean, I would not necessarily be opposed to it if it was done in a bipartisan way through the traditional rules order, which is a 2/3 change. If both parties want to get rid of it, you know, hey, you know, I'm not gonna be a lonely voice in the wilderness. I still would have a concern about bills being able to not just get passed but get repealed quickly with every pendulum swing, which I think would be very destabilizing. I mean, the passage doesn't bother me; it's the repeal part that bothers me. But I would not be concerned about procedural retribution escalation if it was done in a 2/3 way and not a nuclear option way. But of course, that's not going to happen here.
Yeah.
And what I find strange is we're having another round of eliminate the filibuster chatter, which I think is large in part driven by this Ezra Klein column in the Times last week, where he was a very, very big sweeping column. Democrats are going to lose in 2022 unless they you know, do the lion's share of their wish list, and they can't get their wish list done without eliminating the filibuster.
Not just lose to Republicans, but he makes the argument that populist nationalists thrive when the perception is that liberal democracy doesn't work, that it's inefficient, that it's impotent. And so basically, I think what Ezra is saying is like, we have to burn the village to save the village. We have to throw out norms and institutions and beef up democracy, make it more powerful and effective, get rid of this gridlock stuff that the founding fathers liked.
Which is quite counter to the professors who wrote How Democracies Die argue, where they say that you know, when you start doing an escalation of norm shattering, those are the things that feed populism. And I didn't.
That is what I think. I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my perception is that that's Ezra's argument, that in order to save liberal democracy, the Democrats have to essentially seize power and show that they can do this. We'll call it a blitzkrieg of bills, and, you know, like this powerful show of force to get things done, because otherwise populist nationalists, Trump people, will exploit the fact that liberal democracy has this inefficiency and gridlock and nothing gets done.
Well, and the premise of that is that there is no way Democrats can get things done otherwise. Republicans, there won't be 10 Republicans to help out. Mitch McConnell will call the shots. They'll grind you into dust. You'll have your hands tied and you'll look pathetic. And I never can argue here with certainty that those 10 Republicans are going to materialize. But I do think it is premature to base your entire argument saying, you know, that's what's going to happen, or it's a near certainty that's what's going to happen. Therefore, you have to do these other things. And so before I get deeper into, you know, my counter argument there, I find the discussion strange, because it was already the case before this week, before Ezra wrote the column, that Joe Manchin said flat out, I am not eliminating the filibuster. He said that before the election. He said that after the election. Kyrsten Sinema said back in 2019, there is no way, no how I'm eliminating the filibuster. People keep saying they'll change their minds. They'll change their minds when the obstruction comes. And, you know, I can't predict when someone's going to change their mind, but they have made very unequivocal statements. There are other people who have said, my inclination is to keep the filibuster. I want to work with Republicans, but we'll see what
Tim
they
Kaine.
Do. You know, Tim Kaine, John Tester, yeah. Chris Coons, there are people like that. Manchin and Sinema have not done that. They've given themselves zero wiggle room. You know, people can flip-flop. You know, George Bush said, read my lips, no new taxes, and he flip-flopped. It happens. But you, generally speaking, you don't try to make yourself exposed to being a massive flip-flopper, and you give yourself the wiggle room if you think the possibility exists that you might change your mind. And so after Ezra's column, Manchin reiterated it again, and Sinema reiterated it again. And so Mitch McConnell, who was holding up the organizing agreement, trying to get Schumer to make a pledge to not eliminate the filibuster under any circumstances, McConnell says, hey, you don't have Manchin and Sinema. That's good enough for me. We can go forward. People, we're not eliminating the filibuster. It can't be any clearer. That's not going to happen. So you might have this fantastic argument why we should. It's not happening. So proceed on this basis that you're going to have to find 60, unless there is an exception here. The exception is budget reconciliation. And that could happen. And just so folks understand the procedural technicalities of this. So budget reconciliation is in the Senate rules, a way to pass legislation without threat of filibuster for items that have direct budgetary impacts. If the Senate parliamentarian says that the impact on the budget is merely incidental, then based on the plain reading of the rules, it can't go in the bill. So there is an argument, for example, that 50 minimum wage, it has some indirect impact on the budget. It's going to change the money in people's pockets and put them in different tax brackets. It's going to, you know, the federal contractors who will get paid differently. It doesn't have a non-zero impact on the budget, but the parliamentarians say, yeah, but it's not really a direct impact on the budget. It's not like you're putting $500 billion into, direct checks for people. So I say it's not allowed. That's the kind of debate that will occur in the reconciliation process. And you can only do reconciliation after you pass a budget resolution. A budget resolution is non-binding. It does not go to the president. It's supposed to be a guideline for crafting your budget for the year. And in that budget resolution, you include reconciliation instruction. So you say you can do a reconciliation bill that covers these issues and that takes legislation from these committees. So Democrats are proceeding with a quickie budget resolution so they can do a reconciliation bill based on their own argument if Republicans don't cooperate. So they're kind of moving on two tracks. They have the bipartisan COVID relief talks going, but they're saying, hey, if they don't...
And they can do... This is based on the fiscal year, right? So they could do two in the next 12 months. Is that right? Or more? I don't know.
I think you can fudge it a bit. I mean, you do a budget resolution for a fiscal year. Republicans in 2017 did two resolutions... And the first one was a quickie one to try to repeal Obamacare, which failed. Then they passed a second budget resolution with different reconciliation instructions so they could do the tax cut. And that was within the same calendar year. So you can do it, but you can't do it every week. You can't do it for, you know, 20 yeah. individual bills. You only get a few bites of this apple. And for Democrats... They have no margin of error here. If they're going to pass something on a party line vote through reconciliation, they cannot lose a single senator, and they can only lose five House Democrats, as the things currently said. There's some vacancies in there, so that number might move a little bit. So can they give you an example here of where I think this people's expectations, I think, are out of whack? Bernie Sanders introduced the $15 minimum wage bill yesterday. It has 38 sponsors. 38 is not 50. So there's this assumption that everybody in the Democratic Party agrees on 15. It's in Biden's $1.9 trillion relief package. Now, there are already Republicans saying, hey, I want to work with you on COVID relief, but $15 minimum is not germane to that. So I'll talk to you, but I think you got to take some of these unrelated items out. Some Democrats will say, okay, well, you can take them out, but I'm going to put them in reconciliation. Are you sure you have the votes for doing that in reconciliation? Now, maybe they do, or maybe they can get it. Maybe, you know, look, you know, Biden wants it. Schumer and Pelosi are for it. It's got the majority of the Democratic caucus. Maybe the pressure will be put to bear on the others to get on board. But you got to get everyone on board. And if you don't, if you go down the reconciliation path, you actually have the bill and you lose and you don't pass 15, there's going to be a lot of intra-party recriminations that occur. I mean, so the Republicans are having their own civil war right now. You're going to have a lot of angry Democrats who were told this was a must-pass item, and their party doesn't do it. So my point is, you know, there's certainly times in life when you should fight the fight, knowing you can't win, but do your best and see if you can.
Isn't it best for people like you if Democrats actually try and fail to grasp the brass ring, as opposed to not doing that, and then Ezra is gonna, if anything goes wrong, people like Ezra are gonna be able to say, see, I told you.
Well, look, I'm not against 15. I mean, I'm not gonna be sad if 15 minimum passes. If they have the votes, great. I think people should tread carefully and not get out over their skis and do something that's gonna sap their own political capital and make it hard to be a unified party. Now, you know, maybe they go forth and say, look, Joe Manchin says, look, I'm not going to do 15, but I can do 12. And they do 12 and, you know, there's some grumbling, but we move on. I mean, that's also a possibility here. But I just think people are going forth, particularly on 15, thinking it is something Democrats unquestionably can do on their own.
Yeah.
But even with budget reconciliation, compromise will be required. Ducks have to be lined up. And if Democrats don't do a good job managing expectations there, they could get burned very badly.
Well, let me just say two quick things. One, this goes back to where I was before with my column at the Daily Beast. I don't think people who voted for Joe Biden, when I say people, I don't think that like a lot of suburbanites like me who voted for Joe Biden did it to get a $15 minimum wage or thought that's what they were voting for. And so to abandon Biden's brand about working together and bipartisanship and all that, to immediately abandon that and like blow up, nuke the filibuster, if they could, they can't, but if they could, and destroy those institutions, I think that would be like really a bait and switch. And I think it could have electoral ramifications. I mean, Democrats are going to be up in 2 years. They've got a 50-50 Senate, a narrow House majority. Midterms tend to go against the incumbent president's party. So I think Democrats could be setting themselves up for, despite all the Republican problems that we just recounted. But let me just say something about the filibuster real quick, Bill. I think if we just talk about what should it be, not what is, not what's possible, but like I think 60 is probably too high a bar. But what about 55? Isn't the answer to this really a compromise on that? Shouldn't it be 55? If you can get 55 votes, then you could achieve cloture.
I don't have a personal problem with that. I think you will need to find 67 senators willing to change the rules through traditional rule-changing means. I just don't think... I think there was... I gotta go back and read the details of it. Because there's this debate over, in reconciliation, there's kind of a quasi-nuclear choice that could be made here. And this speaks to your point about institutions and norms. It's not a violation of norms to pass $15 minimum wage. I mean, minimum wage has been decreased over the time before. If they're doing it through reconciliation, and if the Senate parliamentarian says this is not allowed under, quote-unquote, the Byrd rule, Democrats could then overrule the Senate parliamentarian by a simple majority vote, exploiting a rules loophole, and that is kind of a semi-nuclear option. And that might make Republicans very angry and might say, well, we're going to have retribution, we're going to throw more procedural sand in the gears, and we're going to do the same, you know, right. when it's our turn. Cruz tried to push that for Obamacare repeal, and Republicans did not go along with that approach. So to get back to, I'm losing my chain of thought a little bit. I don't think, I mean, a lot of Democrats are going to say minimum wage is popular. Biden ran on it. This is not a bait and switch. He ran on $15 minimum. Every time there's been a minimum wage ballot initiative in a state, blue state, red state, it passes. So they're not taking a big political risk by pushing hard on it. And they're not going to care if there's some procedural bending of the rules to get there because it's a popular thing. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, where I think minimum wage is a particularly tricky issue is it is certainly popular in the main, but it can engender very intense opposition from local small business owners who can carry a lot
who are, by the way, being squeezed right now because of COVID. I mean, think if you're a small restaurant struggling to keep your doors open, the government has... you can only have 40% capacity, or you have to close now, and now you can open back up. Oh, by the way, you're going to have to pay $15. Now, if you have in New York City, maybe that's fine. But you're not in New York City, and now we're going to raise the price of labor for you as well.
This is why there's openings for compromise here. You could maybe have this be 15 some places and not others. You could have different time frames for different regions or different states or different communities. I think Hickenlooper is nominally for 15, but in kind of a hybrid way. And so he ran on his particular proposal as a Senate candidate, but is not a sponsor of the Bernie Sanders bill. So there are potentially ways to address those concerns, but it's not as simple as minimum wage polls well, Democrats can pass it without any concerns. There still may be headwinds and potentially fatal headwinds if not handled delicately. And I just don't think they've started the debate by communicating that there are challenges ahead. There's a wide assumption this is a slam dunk for Democrats, and it might not be a slam dunk.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Bill, there were a lot of people who just couldn't bring themselves to vote for Democrats. No matter how bad Trump did or how horrible Trump was, some of them voted for Trump, even though they thought he was horrible, because they had such fear and hatred for Democrats. And then Biden kind of runs as like, well, you don't have to be afraid of me, though. And now, you know, you're going to be in a position where some of the stereotypes about Democratic policies killing business, and there's going to be restaurants that would close down probably because of this. And then when you throw in some of the impacts of some of the environmental policies that, you know, you can argue that in the long run, there are going to be clean jobs that are created, clean tech jobs that will make up for it. But in 2 years, when Democrats are trying to win the midterms, I'm not sure how that's going to play out. So especially among, you know, the working class Americans that are likely to be the hardest hit by this stuff.
But I don't think the Democratic Party as a whole is insensitive to that. I mean, that's why there are 38 sponsors and not 50. There are plenty of Democrats who are aware of the small business issue. I think Biden has always been a pretty balanced sort of trying to be a working class guy who also has an ear on the business community. So I don't think that at the end of the day, they're going to go off half-cocked. But I just think it's going to be a messier process than is assumed right now. And if enough Senate Democrats go forth thinking they can squeeze the other 12 on board without much compromising, you know, then you might get a reconciliation train wreck.
Yeah.
That would be very embarrassing for Democrats. So I just think it would be better for the party if there was more expectation setting going on right now. I mean, it's tough because you want to build the head of steam. You don't want to undercut your own negotiating position. But if you don't set expectations properly, you might, you know, engender more disappointment and intra-party anger.
What's interesting is Ezra and I have conflicting political analysis, right? Mm-hmm. And in both cases, it may be that we have that we are biased, that our biases are creeping in. So, but I think Ezra's sense is that Ezra's sense is that if Democrats don't go big and like make a huge power grab, and let's be honest, the goal here is to, so the problem with killing the filibuster is that Republicans very well could take the Senate in 2 years and then they would be able to push through whatever they want. In this case, Biden would still be president, but you get my point. At some point, the danger is that something will come back to bite Democrats when Republicans take over. But I think part of the plan, of course, is to do other things that would like add new states that would make it less likely that Republicans would ever.
Of course, these things are non-starters. They have not eliminated the filibuster. They can't make D.C. and Puerto Rico a state on a party line vote. Like they can't. They certainly can't do that. I mean, maybe there's some real hardcore folks that think they could do it through budget reconciliation by overruling a parliamentarian. But I'm quite confident Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema aren't going to do that. So, like, those ideas should be put on the shelf. They're not going to happen. But for the point of, you know, engaging, you know, Ezra on this point, which I did try to do in my unpublished piece, you know, there is this, I mean, a lot of the analysis flows from I think, a misread of the Obama presidency, where the argument is they were too timid and too ineffective. They had a stimulus that was too small. They had an Affordable Care Act that was too complicated and bulky. And they didn't go to the mat on, you know, quote unquote, pro-democracy initiatives like enfranchising D.C. and Puerto Rico. You know, if people forget this, there actually was an attempt in 2009 to give D.C. voting representation in the House. And a bill passed the Senate that would make the D.C. delegate a voting member and add a House member for Utah. And it also had a rider that killed D.C.'s strict gun control measures. That's how they got a handful of Republicans on board. And so that bill went to the House, and the House Democrats said, we don't want to mess with D.C.'s gun control regulations. And there also was this side debate over how to structure Utah's new seat. And the House Democrats wanted to make it an at-large seat, and Orrin Hatch didn't like that, as opposed to creating a new congressional district. So there was that debate. And so the bill died in the House. And so my point there is, it's not that Democrats didn't try to do something on D.C. voting rights, but they knew they could never do it in a partisan way. They could never do it in a way that said, we're just giving ourselves two senators. See ya. That wasn't going to fly. They probably, I can only assume, did not have the votes among Democrats to do that. You know, so you have a D.C. statehood bill that was introduced last Congress. Almost every Senate Democrat is for it, was a sponsor of it, except for among those currently in the Senate now, Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, Independent Angus King. And you would need all three of them if you want to do something really creative, like getting that done through reconciliation, let alone finding 10 Republicans who are willing to do it through regular means. There are not enough votes among Democrats to do something that can be tarred as a power grab. The talk about D.C. statehood in the past always was, how can we do this in a way that would be balanced so Republicans don't think we're trying to do a power grab and we're doing the morally right thing in enfranchising people? The Democratic partisans pushing us now have forgotten all that, are trying to do it through a unilateral way, but they don't have the votes for it. And so it is not going to happen.
Yeah.
And so if you're like Ezra and you're saying Democrats are in the wrong, Democrats are being immoral, Democrats are not defending democracy unless they do this, unless they break all these norms to do this, then they are essentially bad people. That's what's going to screw Democrats in 2022. If you're going to start a Democratic civil war by holding up an unrealistic bar of success that you know they're not going to meet and then harangue them for it, that is a bad way to go into your midterm election.
Yeah. No, I think his point is his belief. And by the way, you're totally right. He spent four paragraphs or something like that talking about how the Obama administration, you know, was basically a failure, it seemed to me. But I think his argument is essentially that if Democrats don't do these very aggressive things, then there will be gridlock and stasis, and that will cost them politically. And my argument is the opposite, which I think a big challenge, a big problem is that, see, Joe Biden doesn't really have a mandate. His mandate is fix COVID and don't be Donald Trump. And by the way, Republicans did pretty well. I think Donald Trump sabotaged Georgia, but Republicans did very well in the Senate and the House. So I think that the bigger danger for Biden is in misreading or overreading his mandate and trying to do too much progressive stuff too soon. So we disagree, and maybe it's a Rorschach test, but Ezra and I disagree, I think, over the political analysis.
Well, I think Ezra misreads the lessons about the Obama stimulus. I mean, so he's following the narrative that it was too small, they compromised too much, and that's why the economy was weak. And a weak economy also made people think that government was ineffective, and that helped elect Donald Trump. Now, I think this ignores that Obama got reelected. He got reelected because he credibly argued that the economy was on the mend. Now, granted, it was a slow recovery. It did not go fast enough to help Democrats in 2010. But what I think we miss here is, number one, that stimulus was not going to pass with a bigger number. Not only did the three Republicans who came on board, Spector, Collins, Snow, insist on a lower price tag, so did a whole bunch of Democratic moderates. McCaskill, Ben Nelson, Evan Bayh, there was a whole bunch of them, more than the three Republicans. So it just wasn't going to happen. And would Democrats be better off saying $1 trillion or bust and going bust and not doing anything on the economy? How would 2010 look then? How would 2012 look then? I personally think a whole lot worse. So to my mind, the and another piece of this is, as far as parallels to today.
You're talking to Matt without me?
I'm talking to Matt without you, yes.
How dare you?
I'm sorry.
How dare you?
You're having school without me. How dare you?
Yeah, how dare you?
Okay, can I finish my thought, please?
Fine, finish your thought. Right. It's my turn.
All right. Remember, 2009 was a financial crisis.
No, 2009, I was born. Nothing can be a crisis if Lass is born.
Well, I'm sure the end of the financial crisis began with your birth. Financial crises are notoriously slow to recover from. We are not in a financial crisis. We're in a health crisis. Now, I'm not an economist, and I can't tell you exactly what the rebound is going to be like after the vaccinations occur, but neither can most other people. So to say you have to get this number for your COVID relief bill or else all is lost, or else you're going to lose 2022, that is a level of clairvoyance I'm not going to claim to have. I think Biden is better off talking to the bipartisan group of 16, figuring out a price tag that's acceptable to everybody else, doing the best that he can. And maybe it's not going to be the perfect number. Maybe it's not going to help as many people as we all would like. But that's where, Ezra's bottom line is a Democrat should help people and do it fast. Well, sure, but that also means not getting hung up on perfection. And doing the best you can with the Congress that you have, and setting expectations appropriately, explaining, hey, we're doing what we can here. We'll try to improve as we go along. If there's a need for more help later, we'll try to go back and get it. But we got to work. We got to find where the common ground lies, and this is it. And if you're going to harangue people for doing their best under trying circumstances, I think that's a bigger risk for 2022. Than setting expectations that can't be met.
And you don't go to war with the Congress you wish you had, or you might have, but with the Congress you have.
It's so, my turn.
Okay, what's your political point that you
want to
make?
Time to announce the very special birthdays of this week. Mochi and Sparky are cats. Yes, folks, they've turned one yesterday. Go celebrate their birthdays. They wore birthday hats. They got a unicorn-shaped tunnel. They have it all. Okay, bye.
Republic service announcement.
That Bill, how did you not leave with the birthdays?
You save the best for last. That's why you get a special treat if you stick out the whole hour of us yabbering.
Bill, I've been watching Pluto TV on my iTunes,
and I've been doing so on my Amazon Fire Stick.
Johnny Carson shows. There's Family Ties. There's Happy Days.
There's a 24/7 Family Ties channel. There's a 24/7 Johnny Carson channel.
But you know what else there is, Bill? There's a Steve Bannon channel, and there's a Newsmax channel, and there's an OAN channel, and there's a The Blaze channel.
Well, when I first discovered the app, I was like, oh, this is how people get OAN. I had no idea people get OAN because this is what you have to do to get it.
So, the production values are pretty good, and it's free. Here's the thing. David Frum was just tweeting about how, they're cord cutters, people who don't have cable anymore. And but because more people are, maybe using Roku or Apple TV, and they're streaming Hulu and Netflix and Disney and all that. But you can get this Pluto for free. It doesn't. Once you have an Apple TV, you could watch Newsmax all day long for free. And there's a lot of free stuff, and it does make me wonder: is this not going to make us? Now, granted, we'll be watching plenty of Johnny Carson and Family Ties, but we may also go crazy from the other stuff on that platform.
Now, what's the best Johnny Carson bit or guest you've seen in your nostalgic deep dive?
Oh, I'm 2 days into it. Yesterday, Don Rickles was on, and apparently he was it must have been a cancellation. So he comes in last minute, and he gives Johnny hell for that. And they had a really good rapport because they were like real friends, you know, in real life. And I guess Johnny and Ed Sullivan and Rickles would go out drinking, you know, for years ago. And then Truman Capote was on 2 days ago, which was interesting. I mean, think about it, like a show where you would have a famous author on to talk. That's not really the kind of thing maybe that happens so much today.
I think some of the, I think like James, I mean, not that I've watched him a whole lot, but I think like Seth Meyers and James Corden try to do that from time to time, try to recapture some of that literary spirit.
But I am a Carson fan, and call me old fashioned, but I don't think anybody is up to the Carson, you know, standards. He's in Cooperstown.
You know, I don't think I can bring myself to watch a lot of Johnny Carson. It was always an ongoing argument with my father because he was diehard Johnny Carson and I was David Letterman, and I'd always be like, you know, no one's as good as Johnny Carson. No one can do it as well as he could. I was like, oh God, Johnny Carson's so boring. You know, it's all so
maybe this is the generational difference between us, Bill.
Well, maybe I feel like if I started going down a Johnny Carson deep dive, I'd feel like, you know, my father has won. My father has won the battle, so I just don't hope I can do it.
You know, I will say it was very uncomfortable watching Rickles. Because, I mean, his whole shtick is being a jerk, but he was, you know, talking about this trip he made to the Far East, and there were lots of politically incorrect impersonations.
You want to see something? If you want to see something uncomfortable,
I was offended by it. And I'm watching it alone. It wasn't like I would have been laughing except so-and-so's in the room. Bill Scherer's next to me on the couch. I felt uncomfortable with this.
If you want to feel uncomfortable, go to YouTube, search Don Rickles, Ronald Reagan, and Emmanuel Lewis.
Okay. That's a motley crew, but okay.
Rickles and Emmanuel Lewis did a bit for Reagan's 84 inaugural celebration. And there are some uncomfortable moments that would not fly if they happen today,
I'm sure.
Anything else we need
but
to talk?
You know what's going to happen, Bill? They're going to trot out old episodes of the DMZ the Weekend Blog from 2009, and there's going to be you doing unfortunate impersonations, and you're going to get canceled, and you know, so times change is my point.
That's true. Anything we need to talk about before we wrap up? Because I got two kids at home, remote schooling, and got to feed them.
You got a birthday celebrations for the cats, and you got a battery that's probably about dead.
Well, I moved inside to plug in.
Okay. I'm good, man. I'm good. I feel like I was able to attack everybody today, so that's a good day.
Hi, Simone. Hi. Are you on a break?
No, it's Wednesday.
Oh, that's right. Wednesday is independent work day, so it's basically one long break.
Hello, microphone.
Do you have any work to do today?
Of course I have work to do today.
Okay.
But I'm not doing the work right now. I'll do it right now.
How's your editing project coming for the DMZ Junior?
Oh, jeez, you know, that's gone nowhere. I should get back to that.
Birthday boy.
I say we start over with a whole new one. After we instruct, we learn the lessons from the first episode. We instruct them how to be professionals like us, and we go for a new one.
Well, we should do that. Let's work out a time where they could do another session.
I like it. Okay. All right.
We DM Zooming on Friday?
Well, the question is, are you going to show up this week? Or are you going to bail on me again?
I will show up this week. I'm sorry that I had a conflict last Friday.
See, that's why you're Father of the Year, because you you did the right thing. Choosing between me and your many fans, you chose to do something with your daughter.
I wish I said that made me a hero, but that... like my politics, I parent in a very pragmatic pragmatic mode. So
just muddle through, Bill.
I did what I had to do, not because I'm better than anybody else.
I think we should do Friday. We'll have to settle on a time, but I think the audience demands it. So,
all right. Till next week. Always good to talk to you, Matt Lewis.
Good talking to you, Bill Scherer.
And I'll see you on Friday in the Zoom and back here in the DMZ next week.
You got it. Cheers.